Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Starz production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 110 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This week, we are discussing chapter 24, entitled Something in French.
You did it last week.
Yeah, I did it
under duress, but I'm going to let you do it.
No, I did it last week, and then you said, actually, that's about what I was going to say, so let's hear it again.
No, I'm good. Go ahead.
I almost said le. The Bois de Boulogne.
There you go.
Before we actually get to the chapter proper.
Chapter? Propter? Chapter proper?
Thank you.
Proper chapter?
Spooner mutt?
Nope. That's Spoonerisms?
Scary. Yes. Ellen, who contributed comments for this chapter, writes, I wasn't really excited about reading this chapter, knowing what would happen. And I think we don't disagree.
I feel that way about a lot of chapters, to be honest with you.
A lot of books. Maybe just chapters. The book is an experience. An individual chapter where you know something sad or bad or happy or whatever is going to happen can make you kind of go, ugh. Whereas a book is typically like, oh, this is the story of how they did this or how whatever happened. But yeah, chapter's a little more specialized and
well, it's like
narrow.
The whole beginning of this book. It's like you start reading and you're like, I don't care what's going on in the 1960s. Take me back to where you left me. And it's like you have to get through the first, what, three chapters?
Or six, something like that.
However many. That's just like... You have to get through those chapters to get on to the rest of the story.
I want to know, listeners, I don't know if we've ever asked this question before. Has anyone... I know a lot of people have gotten the whiplash. I know a lot of people have started and, like, had a big old WTF moment.
And thrown the book across the room? I've heard that a lot.
Yes. But has anyone those feelings or no? Well, I guess if not, you wouldn't care. You would just do it. But has anyone actually started it and gone, excuse me, and then just, like, skipped ahead until they found the word Jamie and Claire?
All I know is that I think the next time I do a read-through on my own, obviously not...
So not with me not for a podcast.
With people. I'm going to skip the beginning part, get right to where it ended, and then at the very end of that portion, then read the beginning and end.
It would help you...
I will read the framing story at the end.
That would be an interesting way to do it, especially if you already know and you're not going to be...
Oh, I'm doing it.
It's not going to spoil anything for you because you already know what happens. But that would be interesting because then you're not having to try and remember the stuff that happened like 100 years ago. We have a few new contributors this week. Melissa, a comparative literature major and English teacher, has joined us and we are stoked. As far as I know, we haven't had a comp lit major join us. So we have high expectations, Melissa. And welcome. She writes, it's the turning point of the novel. This is what sets them on the road toward the climax. In literary terms, this is where Caesar gets stabbed.
Ah, very... Caesar got stabbed in his penis?
That took me a second. I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, and then you're clamping onto the word where. That's why. As in the location of where he got stabbed? No, not the penis. The back. Actually, all over.
I'm just saying, but as we move forward with this chapter...
I apologize. Blackjack
gets stabbed in the
penis. I apologize, Melissa, for my sister's words.
Don't apologize. This is the chapter where Blackjack gets stabbed in his penis.
In the dinghopper, yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
No, that was the fork.
I was just trying to make the...
Don't fork. Spoil that.
I'm just kidding.
I was just trying to make, you know,
Connie writes, Bois de Boulogne. The forest was later established as an official park, but was not so at the time of Dragonfly and Amber. Very interesting. I did not know that. And I did read a little bit about the Bois, trying to find an image for that little, I don't even know if you call it a meme. The image I put up with the words, I used word swag to put up the, here's the chapter, here's the date that it's due, here's the email, here's the phone number, right? That little thing I put up on social media, that actually was a picture of the Bois. The actual real live Bois. But I didn't read enough. I looked up for it, but I never read too much about it to find out the date of the park or anything. So the chapter opens in Paris in their apartments. Claire is home. Jamie is out. An Italian person, she is told, stops by to see Jamie. She knew right away from the description that it was Charles Stewart, who was surprised to see her and not her husband. He said he wouldn't stay, that he'd only stopped by to make a request of, quote, my friend James. Connie writes, we learn that Murta has left for Lisbon that morning with vials of nettle juice and madder root in his pouch. And I thought, do we really need to point this out? Because it's in the chapter, and it's interesting, but Connie has a good point. For later in the chapter developments, Murta is not on hand to help Claire. So that, I don't think... That's actually a good point. So, Murta couldn't have helped save the baby, obviously. But what do you think... What could Murta have done? He could have been there to run... Distraction? What do you call it? What
was the interference?
Term? Thank you. Apparently, I'm distracted. He could have run interference, taken some notes, do whatever. With him... Between him and Fergus doing stuff, they could have helped him.
To be honest, I'm fairly sure that if Murta had been there, Jamie would not have gone to the brothel.
Ah, you would have said Murta. Okay. Yeah. Oh, and then he... Oh, yeah. Okay. So, a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So that is very important. Or a very good observation. Claire replies that she thinks he'd be happy to help, meaning Jamie, if he can. Charles' response? All sweetness. He seems to really, truly hold Jamie in great esteem. He uses words like devotion, service, and loyal. Remember these terms.
Well, it's a sharp contrast to the message that Jamie was being sent in the last chapter.
The request that he has is that Jamie handle the disposing of his cargo once it arrives. Because, and this is the, I almost said the alcohol, the port, yes. Because it would be unseemly and inappropriate, he says, for one such as himself, a royal, to do so. Claire bites her lip, and I presume this is to keep from laughing or smiling.
Or saying something.
Yeah, exactly. Like some retort.
Which I wish she would do that more often sometimes.
Our doctor friend, Sarah, has also joined us for the first time. Welcome, Sarah. Sarah writes, the guy is essentially, meaning the prince, the guy is essentially a pauper and yet looks down at any aristocrat who has moved with the times by engaging in trade. And then she writes, oh my gosh, a profession. So middle class, LOL. Sarah goes on to say, the prince states, it is not appropriate, you know, Sarah's aside. Come on, my Lady Brachturach, do I really need to explain this? For a person such as myself to be seen to engage in trade, Sarah comments. He has no problem using his friend, Jamie, who is engaged in such bourgeois pursuits. Well, I guess his blood is not blue enough for the prince. He is certainly not coming off as a heroic figure in Diana's world. I don't know what world. I mean, apparently, okay, I guess in old-timey Scottish world. I don't want to offend anyone, but yes, okay, it's fair to say, in Diana's fiction, he does not come off as a hero.
I think that the thing to take into consideration is that were they on Scottish soil, and were this not in that time period, that era of, like, the brewing uprising, he would not have been friends with Jamie. Jamie would have been a servant.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been somebody that he expected to do things for him, and he would not have been as open to the friendship that he's created with him.
Yes. He definitely wouldn't have been maybe friendly, but if they were on Scottish soil, Jamie was a landowner, so he would have, I don't know what, he was a my lord, whatever that would have been, I don't know. But yeah, it's interesting to see if they had you changed the place, not even the time, just changed the place and the circumstance a bit. And of course they wouldn't be hanging out and going to brothels together. I mean, it's just, right. Yeah, not going to happen. So Claire inquires about a possible partner. And Charles says he has one, a Frenchman, but that he prefers to work with a countryman. Now, Summer, this made me laugh. Jamie is as much his countryman as, I don't know, what's a good analogy? I mean, Jamie's Scottish through and through. Charles may be Scottish through his father's... or
through parentage.
Through his parentage. But to say he is...
He's never lived in Scotland, correct?
I don't believe so. He grew up in Italy.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It made me laugh to go, excuse me? Connie writes, French nobles who engaged in, quote, trade with both hands whenever the chance of profit was offered. Connie says, I have read probably thousands of romance novels in which a British attitude of being in trade is looked down upon by the moneyed classes. I haven't read enough French literature to substantiate that the attitude of the French nobles was different.
That's something that is alive and well today.
In France?
Everywhere.
Double dipping? I mean, both-handed trade?
No, just I'm just saying the people who like look down on
oh gosh,
the different classes, like the class wars, for whatever they still reason. Are alive and well.
Absolutely.
It's like somebody with, you know, an office job looks down upon someone who maybe works fast food or
a field worker or
something. I mean, it's all staged and everyone has somebody underneath them that they have to look down upon. So, I mean, it's pretty standard stuff, actually.
It's pretty standard stuff.
I mean, it is. It's sad, but it's true.
Anyway, poor Charles. Again, the irony that he wants to work with Jamie, and the Comte wouldn't have wanted to do any sort of business with him. Jamie. Claire jokes to herself how much easier things would be if Saint-Germain just strangled him himself, meaning Charles, once he found out that he had contracted half of the shipment to his rival.
Yeah, because when you said contracted, I totally thought you were going to say like...
A disease.
No.
A disease.
Yeah, a disyphilis.
I started to say disease and then wanted to say syphilis.
Just like when you said contracted instead of contracted?
So, as he left, Diana writes, Magnus. Oh, sorry.
It's just Magnus.
Well, Davina says Mug. I don't know. Maybe it is. I'll say that. Magnus. My fake Latin. As he left, Diana writes, Magnus, looking dourly unimpressed by the royal visit, closed the door upon him. He didn't say in his face, but I have this image.
Well, it seems like even the working class doesn't like Charles.
No.
Like, they're like, well, there's a reason he's called the pretender. They're like, if you really are a king, why aren't you home being king? Why are you here? Waiting for us to do things for you.
I mean, the French king has not, I don't want to say noticed him, has not officially recognized him there. And so, polite society can't really acknowledge him either. And that doesn't help his reputation, I'm sure, with Magnus. Jamie smiles as he thinks about the Comte's reaction if Charles were to tell him about their business dealings, and he wonders if it would be lèse majesté to, quote, hammer a prince. If not, I hope His Highness has Sheridan or Bahaldi close by when Saint-Germain hears about it. Now, I'm not sure if he meant literally, or if there's a meaning I don't get as far as hammering a prince, like literally, like, hitting him with something.
First, I would like you to translate lèse majesté.
Okay,
I'll go back. Whatever that is.
Sure. Okay. So, lèse majesté is the crime of violating majesty. It's an offense against the dignity of a reigning sovereign or against a state. Connie looked it up and found some interesting tidbits. She says, this is still a thing in some places. In Thailand, on March 9th, 2015, a court sentenced a couple for insulting the royal family and lodging a malicious claim. They pled guilty to the offenses named and were sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. On April 30th, 2015, North Korean Minister of Defense, that guy, was reportedly executed on charges of lèse majesté. So
that guy? What guy would that be?
I don't even want to try and pronounce it. I'll butcher it. It's Korean. So then when Jamie says, I hope His Highness has Sheridan or Balhaldi close by when Saint-Germain hears about it.
Are those, like, bodyguards?
No. So Connie also looked this part up. That would be nice, too. Balhaldi was apparently very involved with the communications between Louis XV of France and James IV, so Charles' father. And Thomas Sheridan was Charles' tutor and is referenced in these passages from the same book by Frank Lynn. And we have some links we'll include in the blog post. And also in that book, Connie points out, and just look at Bonnie Prince Charlie running around in disguises, foreshadowing of his later activities after Culloden. It wasn't the first time.
Was he also dressed like a woman in these other times?
I didn't look at that. He was just dressing in disguises. So, yeah.
So we only have one confirmed episode of drag?
The conversation didn't continue, however, because Magnus appears with a note on a silver tray, as you do. It was to be brought to his attention immediately. The tray. The message on the tray. It was the foreman of the warehouse who'd gotten himself into trouble at a brothel, as you do. He begs pardon but hopes he'll assist him, meaning Jamie. In other words, could you come pay my brothel bill? Jamie decides to go to it, rearranging the tasks of the day, and he takes Fergus with him to carry messages. And this is what Connie was likely referring to earlier and what you said earlier about. And this is where the presence of Myrta may have helped things or prevented a few things from escalating. Claire says to Jamie, "Kind hearts are more than coronets." This is a line from a poem by Tennyson called Lady Clare Vere de Vere, written in the 19th century. Of course, Jamie has no clue about this line, and she does tell him it's from Tennyson, and we'll link to the poem. Sarah writes, "I thought it was interesting. The next morning, as Jamie is getting ready to engage in trade, and Claire relays the prince's message, she brings up a quote, 'Kind hearts are more than coronets.' It's from a poem," and she gives the same title. "The poem is about a vain, highborn lady who woos men only to reject them because they are not worthy of her. It is from the point of view of a potential suitor who sees her game and rejects her. As I read it, I heard Claire giving us a commentary on the Bonnie Prince and what she values. What really makes a person noble is his character and deeds, not his bloodline. It is so telling of Claire's moral code."
Huh. I'm sorry. Talking about Claire's moral code? The Claire who was married and didn't go back to her husband and remarried somebody else. And
don't judge a girl.
I'm just saying. I would have stayed too. I'm just saying. I don't pretend to have
morals.
Kind, really.
Because?
I'm a robot.
Robots don't have morals. See, you think on the same lines. She even gives him a line from Burns. She's sure to mention that he's Scott as well. "Freedom and whiskey gang together." Connie shares a link to the Burns poem with references, and we'll include that as well. Jamie's parting words to Claire are, "I'll be home to my supper, Modena. Keep you well." We learn that Claire had still been having some intermittent bleeding, but just a little bit of spotting, but it's been a few weeks since it happened. And so thus she was keeping to her bed as much as possible.
So is this the 18th century version of "I'll be back" or "I'll be right back," like from horror movies? It's foreshadowing of, always say, like when you're in a horror movie.
You know,
they always
say, "I'll be right back." Okay, I think that may be our title.
Okay.
"I'll be right back." Except.
Well, I'm just saying, it's like every good horror movie, whenever somebody says, you've seen like a scary movie or.
Oh, yeah. Any horror movie.
Or Scream. I think
Scream is the first movie. Oh, my gosh. Is there a noise down in the basement? I'll go check it out. I'll be right back. Yeah. No. And then they all die. No, of course. Never right back. Connie points out something that I had not been calculating. And the last time we heard about or thought about Claire's pregnancy, at least myself, she was about 5 months along. But Connie writes, "We learn that Claire has had no bleeding for several weeks, by which I would say she's at least 6 months along at this point. 5 months, which we already said, plus several weeks equals 6 to 7 months pregnant." When Claire goes down to lunch, she finds out that Jamie still hasn't come home. And I wrote, first sign. OK. Okay. She has lunch and then lies down again. She's not comfortable on her back, can't sleep on her stomach, and she goes to her side. Did you find anything like that when you were pregnant? Did you have, like, certain things, certain positions you couldn't do?
Oh, yeah. By the end, I could only sleep in propped up in a diagonal fashion against the couch.
Not even in bed?
Uh-uh.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I couldn't sleep on one side because that hurt. I couldn't sleep on my back because you're not allowed to.
Really?
Couldn't sleep, yeah. Because it cuts off circulation. What you said, yeah. There's a big vein back there, whatever.
Yeah.
Couldn't sleep on either side because that was uncomfortable. And then shifting, if I was sleeping on my side and I would shift from one side to the other, I had like shooting pains in my pelvic bone. That was great fun. It always feels like someone's kicking you in the crotch. That's a joy when you're trying to roll over and stay asleep. But I would move to the couch. I would start in bed usually, but then I would move to the couch at probably about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning where I would prop up pillows and lay sort of diagonally. So I was like half on my back and half on my side. So I wasn't really putting weight on any
pressure or anything
on anything that could be bad. So that's what I did. And I know people who had heartburn so bad, they had to sleep upright, like in a recliner chair. I didn't have heartburn.
Thankfully.
Just like, you know, shooting pains in my pelvis. That was fun.
Not one, but the other. Oh, you could have had both.
I didn't.
No, but I'm saying.
I guess I could have.
Claire's description continues. Somewhere in my dreams, I thought I felt Jamie near me, but when I opened my eyes, the room was empty, and I closed them again, lulled as though I, too, floated weightless in a warm blood sea. This is one of those things that just, I mean, so Diana. She just sets, she paints, she word paints so beautifully. Late afternoon, she was, okay, this is what I wrote. Tell me what's wrong with this sentence. Late afternoon, she was woman up. Sorry, she was women up.
That's not a word. I mean, it is a word. It's just not the right word. It's not a verb. It's also not a verb. So I'm assuming you meant woken.
I
think
woken. I did. Apparently I did.
I mean, she did woman up and get out of bed.
But it's plural. Women up. I mean, she must have done it really hard.
Well, she was pregnant. There were two of them.
Oh. Late afternoon, she was woken up, and there were visitors downstairs. The Princesse de Rouen, or Louise, and Madame d'Abanville. What?
I'm just saying. Every time you do the French, I'm always kind of like,
That's the German, girl. When I do German, you should be going, oh, wipe your face off.
I mean, no, I didn't say you were spitting on me. I just...
What?
I don't know.
Does it rub you the wrong way?
A little bit, and I'm not sure why. I almost think we should open it up to listeners to... But they have to not be able to speak French. To call in and give us their interpretation of how the French words are pronounced. So that I don't feel so lonely.
What does that have to do with you making faces at my pronunciation?
I'm just telling you.
Is my pronunciation awful?
It just sounds weird in the middle of a very English-sounding sentence. Of a normal
English, American English. Okay, yes. Totally. I get it. No, I totally understand. She goes downstairs to meet them, the two ladies. She says that Louise...
But she eavesdrops the entire way down the stairs.
Well, we're not there yet. She says that Louise visited her often, but she hadn't seen Madame d'Abanville for a while. And she wondered what could bring them there. That's the second sign. As she approaches the drawing room, she hears, "Do you think she knows?" And she pauses outside the door to let them finish the conversation. She is sure, and she's right, that she would get the unedited version.
No, this isn't the first. This isn't the first time she's eavesdrops. Eavesdropped. Maybe the first one. Maybe the first one in this book, but
hiding behind that
tapestry.
Isn't it a tapestry? They totally didn't have that in the book. I mean,
just
in the show.
In the doorway.
No, I mean in the show.
Didn't she eavesdrop something? I thought she eavesdropped something.
But it didn't involve Leary and a carpet or anything. Mm. I mean, a wall hanging. Not a carpet.
Or a merkin, whatever.
It most definitely didn't involve nacho hair.
Whoa, that's a new one. Nacho hair? Your nachos have hair on it?
Oh, that would be disgusting.
That's my point.
When I think, you know when you find, okay,
and
I'm sorry.
It's nachos.
Not that I want to find anything else in my food, but if I find a hair, like even on the side of my plate, if I have a salad... I can't touch any of it. It nauseates me.
You didn't even take a minute to make sure it's not yours?
I have shoulder length, blonde-ish hair. If it's not my length and not my color, there's no consideration.
Well, but if it was your color and it was maybe just breakage, it could have broken off in a little short, curly.
Okay, I wouldn't blame anyone, but if I saw it, I would still... And I'm not talking about, like, all mixed into the cell. That's... Definitely not me. If it came to me like that and I found it in the middle, well, okay, most likely not mine. that would make me gag. But if I came out in the presentation and I saw it on the side, I don't know, it would still just give me like, I can get a real, like our mom with eggs, I can get a real head trip about something and then I just can't eat it. The whole thing has to be replaced. I just can't do it. Now, if I were eating something and then found a hair on the inside, like all woven into it, I would want to go to the bathroom and relieve myself.
Like pee? Because that's what that means.
Exit myself.
Nope. Try again.
Exit the food?
No.
Get rid of it?
Because exit the food implies you're inside of the food.
Have the food exit vertically?
Make, let's see. Okay.
Louis.
I think it was also the way you said it, because it wasn't just that you said Louis, it was like Louis.
Louise and Marie commence conversation about the happenings. Claire stays where she is so she can hear the undoctored account. It's my Lord Brochturach. Only this morning he challenged an Englishman to a duel, she continues. It was at the brothel down near the fish market. Imagine going to a brothel at that hour of the morning. Men are so odd. Anyway, it's just all of these asides are delightful.
Well, I want to say that she wanted the unedited version. The unedited version wasn't that much better than the edited version. Like, their edited version was still pretty, like...
We didn't get an edited version. She's outside the whole time this conversation...
She never went in?
Nope.
Okay.
I thought she did, too. And then as I read it really closely, I was like, dang, homegirl never goes inside. Okay, baby. I love you to the monkeys, but you can't be up here.
I love her to the monkeys?
Yes.
I love her to the monkeys. Louis? I'll do it all night long.
There was a commotion, thumping and shouting, a crash, and an English officer came down the stairs, half undressed, with his wig off, staggering and smashing into walls. And who should appear at the top of the stairs, looking like the vengeance of God, but our own petit James?
Not Louis?
No, it wasn't Louis. I love the fact that they use petit.
Louise, are they using it ironically?
I think yes, but. In listening to Davina's reading, she literally stops and says, in our own petit j'aime. So she emphasizes it a little bit. Louise is incredulous and says, and I would have sworn he was the last, but go on. It's like, doesn't matter whatever doubts she has, she wants to hear the gossip. The Englishman had replied, there's no need for violence, Fraser. You could have waited for your turn, surely. I should have thought, you get enough at home, but then some men derive pleasure from paying for it. Good Louise defends Jamie's attending to his needs at a brothel. Claire is pregnant, and it is a dangerous pregnancy. Jamie then attacked the Englishman, and it took three men to pull them off. When he was let go, he slapped him in the face with his bare hand, which was apparently a great insult, and challenged him to a duel. And then he ran back upstairs. Claire is unwell, and she almost faints downstairs, and Magnus helps her upstairs. She goes to her medicine box to get the spirits of ammonia ready just in case she gets fainty, but she sees a folded piece of white paper. It reads, I am sorry, and then near the bottom, I must, with an exclamation point, and her knees buckle. Ellen writes, the one question I have is why Jamie left the note in her medicine box and not on her desk, wanting to hide it, but not just in case she never saw it? I think that's an interesting observation.
Well, I think he put it someplace where
she would see it.
Well, where she alone would see it.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't get easily thrown away by, like, staff or anything like that. So it was a place where he was sure she would eventually get to and find it. Mm-hmm. And I bet, looking back, if she hadn't found out about it until after the whole thing went down, it would still be there. Like, she would, that might have been the first place she looked.
Mm-hmm. Another wonderful line of Diana's. Lying on the floor with the carved panels of the ceiling flickering dimly above. I think that means dimly. I found myself thinking that I had always heretofore assumed that the tendency of 18th century ladies to swoon was due to tight stays. Now, I rather thought it might be due to the idiocy of 18th century men.
That's a given.
Yeah, and it's a good line. It's a great line. She, of course, knew it was Jack Randall. She just doesn't know why he would want to kill him. Why now, after his promise to her? She thinks that something more than simply seeing Randall at the brothel would have set him off, something that sent him over the edge into rage. Then she thinks of Frank. Quote, "For Jamie, Frank was no more than a ghost, the dim possibility of a refuge for me in the unlikely event of necessity." Ellen writes, "The men in her life are both ghosts, present and past intertwined." That is so true. Connie writes, "The rage that had led Jamie to suffer mutilation rather than bear the shameful mark, burn of Randall's heated signet ring, marking Jamie as his property, could easily break forth again to destroy its inflictor, BJR." Now, it's interesting that Connie mentions the mark of the signet ring. Remember that. She had already chosen Jamie over Frank. This is me again, still. Diana writes, "Frank was the man I had lived with, had abandoned at the last to stay with Jamie Fraser." And then, she says, Claire says, "I can't," I whisper to the empty air, to the small companion who stretched and twisted lazily within me, undisturbed by my own distress. "I can't let him do it." Okay, so I know it wasn't in any way conscious, but do you think that this is another time she makes an important choice? Meaning, the pregnancy was already dangerous, but even knowing this, she went to save Frank, and hopefully Jamie, from doing the deed, and in a way, the child was that sacrifice. She chose Frank over the potential welfare of their child. What do you think?
She definitely risked it.
Yes.
I mean, she couldn't have known that was going to happen.
Exactly, I agree.
But I don't think she did that intentionally. Clearly.
But symbolically.
Make it happen. But yeah, I could see that symbolically being the case.
Mm-hmm. So there was nothing to do that night. She would leave in the morning.
Is this payback for choosing Jamie initially? This time she chooses Frank.
I'm calling that a whole big ball.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye.
So she knew where she would go, into the woods. There was nothing to do that night because Jamie wouldn't be going to the bois that night. It would be in the morning. So she just basically stayed up. She couldn't sleep, obviously, but she didn't want to leave at that time because there was no point. So she said she knew where she was going to go. It was in the Bois de Boulogne.
Which is in the woods?
Oh, bois means wood.
Okay.
Yeah. Or wood. Okay, in the bois. The line, "It was said that wolves as well as foxes and badgers were still to be found there. But the story did nothing to discourage the amorous couples that dallied under the branches on the grassy earth of the forest." What does that make you think of? France? Paris? A wood? Amorous couples? In a little bit of seclusion. Fantine? And her man, who takes her childhood in his stride. Claire's taken a carriage, and there was pain in her lower back. Connie writes, "Remember the last time we heard about a coach ride and how she felt so bad afterward?" So this was another great decision. I mean, she had to do what she had to do, but when they do get to the site, she rushes to the clearing. She hears the metal before she sees them. They were stripped to their shirts, fighting in the rain. She didn't want to interrupt for fear of Jamie being injured. Quote, "All I could do was wait to see which of my men would die." How awful is that? I mean, that line, just... she knew or just thought that one of the men would die. Randall loses his sword. The pain in her back deepens. She feels a sudden breaking. Randall slipped, and Jamie is about to deal what she thinks is the death blow, but Jamie goes for his waist instead. Now, Ellen writes, "Interesting that this chapter is what you will discuss the same week those photos were published of Sam and Tobias at Pollock Park. As she watched Jamie's sword come down, graceful and deadly, cold as death, the point touched the waist of the doeskin breeches, and that is what Tobias had on." How freaking awesome is that? I saw them, like, on social media. If you're on as much as we are, I don't think you can help but see things like that. Didn't spoil anything because we have read the books, but, you know, I don't want to see a lot because, especially if you're a book reader, there's so little to be surprised with. So I saw them, but I didn't, like, blow them up and see what who was wearing what or anything.
Oh, stop. I sent it to you.
You sent it to me, but I didn't. Doesn't mean I blew it up.
And then I said, you're welcome.
Oh, well, and I said, because I'm happy it was a device, so that was always good. Then, just as his sword pierces Randall, there is so much poetry in Diana's words. Jamie's sword pierced and cut down in a twisting wrench that darkened the fawn with a sudden flood of black-red blood. And then, blood was a hot rush down my thighs, and the chill of my skin moved inward toward the bone. So, Summer, I never realized that the ripping, the hemorrhage, whatever was happening to Claire was at the exact moment that Jamie pierced Randall. The exact moment. Blood here, blood here. I was like, holy heck. It's very poetic. Connie writes, Diana says, I could feel the strain as each pain came on, the stroke of lightning flashing down my backbone to explode and flame in the basin of my hips, a stroke of destruction leaving burned and blackened fields behind. This above, what she just quoted, brings to my mind a military scorched earth action to deny sustenance to an enemy and which Claire had seen used in World War II. Sarah shares, as you know, the chapter ends with Claire's sad loss, and she actually tells us the most likely diagnosis, placental abruption. Just a reminder, Sarah is our medical expert. She's a doctor. So Claire is now faux show losing the child. She collapses. Her senses are floating. As people all around her are speaking in French, she hears one voice calling, Claire, Claire. Someone placed a pad of cloth between her legs and rolled her onto her side, her knees up to her chest. One voice suggests she be taken to l'hôpital. Another says she won't live long enough. And another says the bleeding is slowing, she may live, and that she'd seen her at the l'hôpital. Take her to Mother Hildegard. And Claire's last words before she sinks into oblivion is, Mother.
Thought it was she strange did. That there's some random... Yeah, there's no one says she... It says she may live, but none of the people are identified as a female.
Did I say she? And you just said she. She said take her to the hospital.
So it just says one voice.
No, I said, and another says that the bleeding is slowing, she may live, and that she'd seen her. Oh, that's a she.
Her being Claire.
Yes, but the she was where I was assuming. Yeah. Take her to Mother Hildegard.
Right, and the only reason I point that out is because she's... What, like, on the ground, bleeding out, or whatever, hemorrhaging. And some random person just, like, shoves a wad of clothing between her thighs. I would have thought
that's more incredibly the a woman thing than a man thing.
I would, well, but it doesn't specify.
I don't disagree, but...
Right.
I think a woman would have more of an idea of what a woman is happening to a woman.
But here's pregnant. The thing. She just collapses. If she's wearing... those skirts and that dress, no one's going to immediately see that she's bleeding out through her whatnot.
There must have been some... she must have been holding up her skirt. I don't know. Somehow, someone saw that she was bleeding. Melissa writes, the miscarriage. Jamie and Claire are so tied to each other, and yet they are forced to be apart during this horrible time. As a modern reader, we know that the miscarriage would likely have happened anyway. She was bleeding not long ago, very late in the pregnancy, but we also know that people need reasons to try and find blame or cause, so this is something that may become an issue in the future. You also have Jamie breaking his word, wounding or killing Jack, for reasons unknown. Then you have Claire believing Frank is dead at Jamie's hand, and ultimately her fault, and then the loss of their baby, a driving force in Jamie's recovery after his treatment by Jack at Wentworth, because it gave him a glimpse of a hopeful future. And they are facing all of these things without the benefit of being together. To top it all off, we ended the previous chapter in such hope. Sandringham could get them a pardon if they would abandon their quest to stop Charles, and there was a plan in place to foil Charles by cutting his income. Things were all coming together, and wham, badness. DG sure knows how to stab you in the heart.
I agree.
DG knows how to stab you, make you elated. She's a magician. And that's all there is. So what's up for next week, Summer?
Next week?
we will be discussing chapter 25, entitled, I would just say Raymond the Heretic, but I'm sure you would probably say Raymond the Heretic.
Pretty much. Raymond.
Anyway, the Heretic, chapter 25.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.